not come from commercial farmers. Actually, $20,000 is peanuts for a gross income test and could easily be subject to abuse. I support this criteria only reluctantly. There is always a generous amount of land zoned RR through the exception process, which is available for those who want a rural residence. You have heard concerns on this gross income criteria from Yamhill County as regards the grape industry. I am not experienced in vineyards, but it appears that again there is a problem of distinguishing what is a viable commercial grape operation, full or part-time, from the starry-eyed people with big visions. Perhaps we need a special zone for vineyards. However, in case such a special zone is designated, there would need to be built-in protection from unsuccessful vineyards becoming candidates for breaking down into smaller parcels. The whole question of what constitutes a commercial farm operation that Goal 3 is to protect needs additional clarification. U.S. Census statistics are too broad to be helpful. May I refer you to Appendix B, which is testimony I submitted at a local hearing. I'd like to read just a couple of paragraphs of that. Appendix B, if I can find that. LCDC Goal 3 mandates a minimum lot size in EFU zones be appropriate for the continuation of the existing commercial agricultural enterprises within the area. Singling out commercial farming in this way implies that there are other recognized forms of farming. I offer the following as a profile of farming. Hobby farming, primarily for enjoyment and lifestyle. Profit is secondary. Living derived mostly from other sources. Commitment can be either high or low. Tax farming, primarily for tax purposes. Other considerations not important. Tax benefits can be realized by investing high tax bracket income into livestock, feedlots, orchards, and etc., or by merely speculating in land purchases where the value appreciates while the interest on real estate mortgage is a tax deduction and then profits from sales are taxed as capital gains. This kind of farming takes low commitment. Subdivision farming. Profit is important. It is generally realized from land conversion to housing developments, but also includes conversion to mini farms for the hobby farmers. Low commitment to agriculture. Subsistence farming, primarily for enjoyment and lifestyle. Provides most of livelihood, but at a subsistence level. Can have other income, but not a big factor. High commitment. Commercial farming, primarily for production, for profit, primarily for food production for profit, generally provides the only source of income, responsible for feeding an unfarmed sector. It requires high commitment. All these forms of farming exist in Oregon. They are all legal and permitted under our land use laws. However, they do not receive equal consideration under Goal 3. When it comes to creating new parcels in the EFU zones, Goal 3 is clearly and intentionally biased in favor of commercial farming. This bias became inevitable with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. In order for the shrinking farm population to feed and clothe an unfarmed sector, commercial farming became a necessity. Urban people have a very real stake in their source of food and have been very supportive of farmland preservation. Commercial farming has two essential components, land and operator. The two together make a commercial farm. In regard to the land component, Goal 3 requires parcels appropriate for the continuation of commercial farming in the area. Returning now back to about page 2. Hearings officer or farm panel for actions in EFU zones. I can support either of these concepts as it would remove the decisions one step from local politicians who cannot stand up against development pressures. The slogan becomes, zoning by crony, get your own cronies in. I see the hearings officer as someone who would professionalize the process. He would have a stake in having all decisions upheld on appeal. For further protection, the law could require the hearings officer's replacement should his batting average not meet a required standard. The county's objection to hearing officer cost would be relieved by a farm panel. Any EFU zone with no development permitted could be administered by farmers, assuring the protection of agricultural land and Goal 3's intent. I take strong exception to the planner's contention that the current provision for planning commission membership is working satisfactorily in EFU zones. Many planners are actually appointed not because they are supportive and intend to implement the law, but just the opposite. Attorney's fees. Some counties are reacting negatively to this provision in the bill. Judging by some past county performance, this is understandable. However, the point of this provision is to exert some pressure on county government to be responsible. The best defense against litigation costs is sound initial decisions and good implementation of those decisions. The counties who are making a good faith effort will not find this a burden. Standing. Some people are misunderstanding this provision. It is not intended to limit standing, but to broaden it. Two commissioners currently in office in Benton County tried to limit standing in local EFU appeals to those within 1,500 feet. Appeals court invalidated the ordinance, but the effort to draft an acceptable ordinance, which continued over many months, and the appeal was costly to the county and also to the citizens who had to pay both their own attorney's fees as well as the taxes to pay the county's cost. I am in favor of opening up standing for appeals in the EFU zones to all county residents. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, urban residents have a stake in resource land that they depend on to sustain them. Farmers do not have a moral right to destroy or impair the resource land entrusted in their care. On Friday, you were told a hard luck story from Benton County where someone was denied permission to divide an 80-acre parcel into 2 40s. 1 40 was to be for Filberts, the other was to be sold in order to finance the establishment of the Filberts. Appendix B contains testimony I gave in that case. If you please turn to page 4 of Appendix B and notice the bottom line in the chart, which shows a gain of over $500,000 in real estate transactions. This agribusinessman, not a farmer, bought these four farms over a period of 5 years, 74 through 79, and sold them over a period of 2 years, 79 through 81, realizing a gain of over $500,000 besides the rent from the land. He probably would not be caught dead in the food stamp line, but he did request partition of a farm parcel based on his financial constraints. In a subsequent hearing, I presented testimony contained in Appendix D documenting that the creation of smaller parcels does to market value of land. You turn to Appendix B, I think that's about the last page. There you'll notice the two top items there, 96 acres and 76 acres. The market, the sale price was $2,400 and $2,500 an acre. The lower two there, where you go down to $36, $46 an acre, roughly breaking those two parcels in half, the value went up to $3,200 and $3,300 an acre. You split that down still further to 20 acres, the price goes up to $5,400 an acre. That concludes my testimony, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kager. Are there questions, comments?
I should have given testimony on the tax thing. Let me just say that I support the tax provision in the 237.
As they're written.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Bert Udell? Udell? Welcome.
My name is Bert Udell, and I'm a small woodland owner from Linn County. My wife and I are National Fruit Farmers of the Year, so I do have a bit of expertise in my field. I probably shouldn't be in here testifying on an ag bill, but I am concerned with the marginal lands. We're talking marginal ag lands, and this is what you're going to make them, but those are also marginal forest lands. And I don't like some of the ideas that are coming out here and what you're going to do with the marginal land if you put them under EFU. to say a little about marginal forest lands, or we'll call it marginal lands. A lot of these marginal lands are becoming forest land, more of them becoming forest land than they are ag land these days, whether it's by accident or intention. The trees will grow in around the perimeters and you get a forest situation. And at that point in time, if you convert to forest land, you're getting a terrific tax penalty, which I think most of you are probably aware of, but anywhere from 5 to 16 times I hear from people that are under this. And I've had people call me and say, hey, I tore up some old pasture land and planted trees, and my God, I'm going out and burn them up, plow them under. I can't afford the tax on it. I can't justify it. This is a thing that has been very inequitable from the woodland owner's standpoint. A small parcel of land lends itself to forestry a lot easier than it does to ag, and that you can take and plant Christmas trees, or you can plant timber trees, or you can plant the combination. Plant Christmas trees and leave some of them for timber trees. And that can be on a small parcel of land. All you need is a couple hundred feet to fall a big tree in, and that isn't that's less than an acre, but we have, I think, a two acre minimum for forest deferral. The forest people now have self-loading log trucks, very portable, and rubber-tired skidders. They come out, pick their logs up, and can do it for as low as a load or two. So it does make it an economical operation, probably more so than if it was into a field of wheat and you had a huge tractor and trying to turn that around. The thing that happens in forest land, I think if you can live on your land, this allows a chance for intensive management. And many people use that. It's kind of a forest therapy situation. And you go out there and plant trees instead of jogging. Or you can go cut some wood instead of beating your wife. Any kind of entertainment like that would help grow some more timber. And we think it's a
beating your wife or planting timber, which one?
Well, I haven't had much luck getting my wife to plant. But she does help. She does help on the tree farm.
Do you like equal time, Mrs.
I absolutely will allow.
One of the problems I see in this marginal lands situation is exists already in EFU, and I'm not going to argue with the EFU people. In my case, it's out in the ryegrass in the valley. I have no arguments with them. They go ahead and they can do their business the way they want to if they let me do mine the way I want to. And we seem to get along pretty well in that arrangement. But one of the facts of life in this farm woodlot is that it requires no management at all. You just let it sit there. If it's brush, just leave it that way. There's no incentive, no objective to get it into timber. And I think that's wrong. I think we should be increasing our timber supply, and we need those trees planted out there. So if they go down and the assessor and apply to get it changed to timberland and go ahead and plant it, then they get a heck of a tax on it every year. It's, as I said before, many times more. I don't know precisely what the answer to this is, but there are a lot of small woodland people that would like to have the benefits of the farm tax, the EFU tax, but I think if they do, or anybody that does, I think should be required to do something in the way of timber development. The gross income test is rather difficult on small tracts of forest land, as you well appreciate. you're making a commitment for, well, if you're growing Christmas trees, we'll say 6-7 years. But if you're going into timber markets, you're making a commitment for 60 years. And there's a long dry spell in there, and it's necessary that you have another job. You work out somewhere, you get income enough that you poke a little into it, you buy a few trees this year and you plant them, and next year you paint a little brush and so on. And I think that's one of the problems I see is the income test. The other problem is penalizing for becoming forest oriented. I think that's wrong. We have bills in from the small woodlands that will, we hope, rectify some of these. One of them is the land under the dwelling. We'll set that at a 10-acre minimum. We don't think that anything that's under forest deferral should be granted the exemption of the land under the dwelling. We'll go along with about 10 acres if it's intensively forest managed. One other thing that I have not seen in this bill, and I think should be, is a freedom to carry on either your ag or your forestry enterprise. And I haven't seen it in this bill, and I think that's an important item. In fact, I see it almost the other way. Somebody that's paying ag taxes down the other end of the county can come complain because I'm doing something he don't like on my forest. And I'd object to that very strongly and strenuously. Probably kick him in the shins if I got the chance. I think basically that's my testimony. I'm sorry. Apologize for not getting it written, and I forgot my copy of the bill and didn't have it with me with my notes on.
I think you certainly shed some light on some of the questions that I've had, and I particularly appreciate your comments concerning the relationship between a special assessment and managing the land to a certain extent.
I think that's necessary.
Is there any questions, comments for Mr. Ito?
Well, Mr. Chairman, before we get through, I'm going to have my own ignorance dealt with somewhere or other to understand the testimony we've had from time to time about the relationship between exclusive farm use zones and marginal lands and woodlots, because I'm having difficulty seeing exactly what it is in the bill that's raising this question. I haven't had it really pinpointed for me in any of the testimony, and I know that that may be obvious to people who understand these relationships better, but I haven't found it yet. So someplace along the line, Mr. Chairman, I hope that can be clarified for me.
I could give you a little viewpoint on it.
Go ahead.
Well, can you, with reference to specific sections in the law?
Not. I don't have the law with me. No, I can't. But they are changing they're throwing out the 20-acre woodlot now and going to a larger size, as I have read the law.
I don't think we're doing that.
The bill.
That would help me see, because I don't see that in the bill. Now, maybe it's in there, but I haven't found it. I keep hearing these generalized statements, but I can't identify anything in it.
All right. I can't.
And it may be in here. I'm not saying it isn't, right, but I'm trying to find it.
There is a copy of the bill there.
That's someone picked it up.
Huh?
Yeah.
Comment?
There's a copy here. I don't have it underscored at this stage of the game.
Why don't you? Are you going to be taken off pretty quick, sir?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Well, maybe why don't you take that with you and maybe you can get back to us.
Why don't I get back to you? I've got a copy at home. I'll leave it here for somebody else.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
But I'd love to write it up and turn it into your committee then.
Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Robert Wilson, Route 2, Box 109, Monroe. And I'd like to express my opposition to the taxation portion of the assessment portion of 237. I've already expressed my opposition to the rest of it. And it just seems, looking over, number one, I believe that the 308 statute, which calls for the special assessments, is adequate in its present form, and it doesn't need a lot of changes to make it work. I don't find in Benton County that there are an extreme amount of people that are being assessed at the farm value that are not farming the land that they're being assessed at the fair value for. And there are always shortcomings, as you all well know, in any law, that somebody gets by with something over the time. We pick up on them and we catch them, either through a reporting system or someone gets all ticked off because he's paying taxes on $1,000 an acre and somebody else is getting by at $237 an acre. And I think maybe instead of all of this legislature that keeps tightening down everything tighter and tighter and we still don't cover the loopholes, let's just look at what we got and try to correct it that way. I got a letter from the educational, the Senate Education Commission the other day because I'm school board chairman at Monroe Union High School. And there's a law in the books that stipulates that part-time teachers or temporary teachers, if they exceed 10 days, they go into a different salary category. Well, some of the larger school districts, when they get to the ninth day, they fire the part-time teacher and hire another one to get over it. Well, I think the idea of that Senate committee was, is, hey, look, we got a red flag coming up. People are cheating. Now, either quit cheating or we're going to change the law on you. And I think 308 in its entirety covers the special assessment. And maybe we ought to just throw a red flag to all of the 36 assessors in the state and say, hey, how about getting off your butts and going out there and looking around and seeing what we're doing? One thing that's always bothered me in the farm community, and I agree wholeheartedly that the farm system needs help, but the farm system has got a lot of special assessments. 5 or 6 years ago, we very quietly removed all of the farm equipment from the personal property tax assessment. No other industry in the state that I know of is eliminated from the personal property tax. And yet they have millions and millions of dollars worth of equipment, and it's no longer taxed. I have a small laundromat in the city of Monroe I run on the side. I'm taxed every year for the machines that I own in that. We keep saying that the farmers are a competitive business, but they keep saying that we need more and more help. I think anyone that has a piece of property that has a house on it has the basic responsibility to pay the taxes that put the kids in that household through the local schools, repair the roads in the county, and run the county government. Now we're saying that the farm dweller, and let's eliminate all the 5 acres, 10 acres, and 20 acres that does not meet a $20,000 income test or some other set of tests, we'll let them get by without paying any tax except on a farm valued rate. Now, I happen to live on a farm, 111 acres, as I told you before. Nominally, that 1 acre in the assessor's office in Benton County would be $14,000, say in a rural residential community. In our county, in my side of the county, for the school taxes in the county, we're paying about $20 a thousand. So nominally that $14,000 1 acre piece under my house should be worth about $280 in taxes. Under the farm assessment, that 1 acre piece, my 1 acre piece, is assessed at $237. That's the farm value land. So instead of paying $280, I pay about $6. And yet my children go to the same community school as anybody else's do. And somebody has to pick up the difference between $6 and $280 or $276 on his tax roll someplace. And why should all the rest of the general public keep paying for these little kids? I live in a house that's worth $60,000. If I can afford the $60,000 house, I ought to be able to afford to pay the tax on it. The same way, in the bill under the special assessment, I find, at least I read it, that what we're trying to do with the new special assessment and the manipulation of 308 with the $20,000 income limitation is we're going to physically say that this small 20 acres and less, and I think that's an accurate figure, 20 acres. I don't think 40 acres would meet the $20,000 income or half income test as one test. But you're going to pull them out of the farm. Well, most of the people that are living on acreages less than 20 acres, years and years ago in 75 and 76 said, I don't want to be zoned to EFU. And the Planning Commission and the County Commissioners and LCDC at their direction went through and broad brushed, saying, here I have 1,000 acres of farmland and everything on the periphery is going to become farmland too because it protects it. But they already exist. So now we're right back to square one. The man didn't want to be in farm zone. You force him into the farm zone. He automatically qualifies for the assessment. Now you're going to take it away from him because you're not big enough. So all I'm asking is that anything in the taxation, you ought to look at it that everybody is treated fairly. I have people have walked up to me in Benton County on a farm, and they brag because they put in a $15,000 swimming pool and got it assessed at farm value because he tied it in as a fire hydrant supplement. Now, a swimming pool is a swimming pool. And a $500 attachment so I can run it to my barn doesn't make it a reservoir for fire protection. It makes it a side issue as a reservoir, and it gives me a little bit of common sense to use what I have on the farm to protect my barn. But I sure as hell shouldn't get away from the idea that I have a $15,000 swimming pool in the backyard.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't current law, though, provide that the assessors to go out there and require the back taxes be paid on that?
Well, not if the assessor to begin and he still can justify in his mind that it's a reservoir, Senator Starkovich, no.
Well, I guess, yeah. Well, I guess my question's half a statement that there's property out there that is assessed farm use that isn't being used for farm use, and somehow the penalty isn't sufficient, or it's not being enforced.
But I think Mr. Bain and the young gentleman from the legislature that briefed initially on this, I don't think either one of them gave the attitude that there's a great deal of property that is being mistaxed. That they're not roaming around in the country and seeing a 100-acre piece or a 20-acre piece that is being assessed at the farm rate and it's nothing but weeds.
So you think they are doing that?
Yeah, I think in most cases they are, Senator. And I would think that going one step further, I can walk around South Benton County and my understanding of the taxation law right now, on a farm parcel that's in farm deferral, I can have up to but not exceed 20 acres that is not in farm ground. It can either be underwater or it can be scrub oak or something else. Once it exceeds that, then it cannot be tax exempt. But I can pick out several places that have 40 and 50 and 60 acres that are in scrub oak, that are not being farmed, that are in the assess roll. But now we're a farmer and let's look at it in a different aspect. And I think the initial drive of the farm assessment was is you go out there and pick this land and you clear it and we'll give you a special tax assessment for it. We also have in the farm community, I can go out and plant Christmas trees, which is a viable crop, and I have no objections to it, with one exception. It is one of the most erosive crops that's ever been known to man because they cannot find a vegetation crop that will not overcompete with the small Christmas trees. And yet, as a farm crop, I get farm deferral, After 7 years, when I start cutting it, it becomes a capital gains tax, and I pay tax on 40% of it. How many things do the farmer need? An IR-1. There has to be a limit to what the public can expect to pay to support the farm industry. It has to start supporting itself. And if they cannot compete, then the poor one should fall by the wayside. And that includes the 20-acre man or the 15-acre man. But as long as he's making an effort right along with the 5,000-acre, and he meets that minimum commitment, then he ought to have the same acknowledged conditions that the big farmer has. He's trying to raise on his 10 acres of land 10 head of cattle, because that's all 10 acres of land will hold. Now, if you falsely put in a barrier on an income test that he can't meet, then why did you ever zone in EFU to begin with? And let's tax him at rural residential prices of $1,000 an acre or whatever, and let him put his house on it. We're arguing all of these things back and forth all of the time, and we created the problem, and we can't seem to get away from it. Any other questions?
Anything else? If not, thank you very much. Don Durkoff?